You're listening to KCSB 91.9 FM in Santa Barbara, and this is Sustainable World, and I'm Jill Cloutier, your host. And thanks for tuning in this morning. And on today's show, we have live in studio Larry Saltzman, the fabulous food forester. And welcome to the show, Larry.
Hi, thanks.
And Larry, with his wife Linda Bazell, is the co-founder of the Santa Barbara Organic Garden Club, which helps local residents wean themselves from dependence on chemical fertilizers, pesticides, and herbicides. And at home, Larry and Linda have planted a gorgeously lavish permaculture food forest on a modest suburban plot. And Larry teaches classes on how to create backyard food forests, he lectures on peak oil, and he's also the co-founder of the International Documentary Association, which is the Professional Association for Nonfiction Film and Video Makers. Larry's also the originator of the Peak Oil Project at For the Future, a nonprofit think tank in Santa Barbara. And to top it off, Larry is also actively involved in the relocalizing food issue. Did I leave anything out, Larry?
No, that's fine.
So that is a lot. I don't know how you do it. This is amazing.
Yeah.
You don't know either?
I don't know.
So what we're going to start the show off with today is I actually went to Larry and Linda's house on Sunday afternoon, or actually morning, and he gave me a tour of the garden. And so what I'm going to share with our listeners is an audio tour of Larry and Linda's backyard food forest. And I wish that the listeners could experience it like I did. There are so many trees and flowers and herbs and heritage roses, and it's just this huge oasis brimming with life. But what I would like to do, maybe, Larry, before we take the audio tour is, could you just give our listeners an explanation of what a food forest is?
Well, it's an attempt to be a recombinant ecology, to mimic a natural forest, but carefully selected to produce the maximum amount of useful products for people. So there's a great deal of food that comes out of it. If this had been built by Native Americans in the past as they did, it would have included lots of products for fiber and medicine and many other uses as well.
And so this is basically, it's almost like you're creating a forest, but it's edibles for
That's
you
right.
to pick and use.
Yeah, it's a designed ecology full of food to eat.
Interesting. Well, what I'm going to play right now is a tour of Larry and Linda's food forest. And keep in mind as you listen that this is all growing, all the things you're about to hear about, on 1/3 of an acre of land. So here we go. This is Linda and Larry's backyard food forest tour. Way to Larry and Linda Saltzman's backyard food forest as I drove through typical suburban streets. I didn't know quite what to expect. As I walked into their house, Larry was busy at the stove, stirring something in a pot. What are you doing right now?
Making an apple quince plum sauce here. The quince is from our garden and the plums are from the garden. The apples are not, but we got those from somebody we stayed with on a trip in Northern California. They gave us a bunch of Gravenstein Golden Delicious apples. They had just hundreds of them. So they're still homegrown apples, and we're making it into a sauce. I mean, we have a freezer full of plums now, and we're going to be having plum sauce off 3 plum trees till probably January.
It smells so yummy.
What I like to do is walk people around the property just to get a sense of the great variety of plants and trees, perennial bushes, annuals, and a great deal of them are edible, of course. And it's a good chance to see a growing food forest and get a sense of how much you can do on a relatively small property. We're, you know, by some standards is a good size, but it's only a little over 1/4 of an acre. And also you can see, you get a sense of how much you can pack in. Behind this fennel, which we use a lot, by the way, fennel is a great thing, most people don't eat it, we have a brand new aprium, which is a new complex genetic cross between apricots and plums, and we're excited to see what this is going to do. And behind that is a hood pear, and off to the side is a kefir pear, which is a fairly old pear. It's about from the 1860s roughly, and it's a cooking pear. You don't eat it so much, eat it raw, as use it to make pear sauce, which is something people don't do. And then here's an apple tree and a blood orange just jammed right in next to each other, and they're both doing perfectly fine. We're about to get a good winter crop of blood oranges.
What I'd like our listeners to know is that the space we're talking about, how big would you say this is, Larry? It sounds like a large, large space, but the plants are very close together.
Yeah, the trees are, in some cases, less than 3 feet apart. You know, they're really jammed in. People don't realize how much you can put in a small property. Mm-hmm. One of the techniques that has been recommended, which we actually haven't done, is you can actually dig a bigger hole and put three fruit trees in one hole and get, you know, plant, stage it so that they come at different times of year. That's another thing we've done here is we've tried to get things so that 12 months of the year we're getting fruit.
This is very different from the usual fruit tree planted by itself. Just there in the barren ground around
and
it.
Also, there's a lot of underplantings under the fruit trees, which is quite intentional. In permaculture, they talk about guilds, which are plants that cooperate together. So we try and do a lot of that. We keep the ground well mulched and covered with compost and mulch, and we really try and do it. So here's a nice pomegranate that's still got fruit on it, and by the time this one finishes, the oranges will be coming in.
And there I see Kuan Yin awaiting us at the end of the path, too. A statue of Kuan Yin.
Yeah, you can't really see, you know. Imagine this if you can't see it, but we have this narrow little space back here behind two hedges that are here, and we're able to put three citruses in a row because of paying attention to where the sun was, and the sun comes up in this narrow arc. It'll get sun most of the day, so we have three different kinds of citruses, an orange, grapefruit, and a lime tree. And again, you know, in sequence, this grapefruit will come in about the time the blood oranges are done. So some of these trees are young, but in a few years, we're hoping that we'll have just continual fruit of some kind all year round.
Well, it sure seems like it, because we are standing here in a little probably 3x3 space, and there is green everywhere, surrounded by trees. Mm-hmm. And roses, too, and flowers.
People should never forget roses. Rose flowers are edible, and the hips you can make tea from. And we put in lots of pretty flowering things too, like I'm looking at some Mexican sage, and that's a great thing for attracting pollinators. So we want to keep the pollinators fed year round, and there's usually something in for the bees and the birds almost all year round, because they're going to come back in the spring and pollinate for us.
This looks like your token lawn.
We have this little bit of lawn left, and we haven't quite been willing to get rid of it, because it's nice to have a teeny bit of lawn, but we let a lot of things grow in it. There's some flowers growing in it. We're trying to make it more like a prairie than a conventional lawn. And then we come to a little miniature orchard here where trees are, again, pretty closely spaced together. We have a whole planting of different kinds of apples. We have one called Dorset Golden, another one called Winter Banana, and a crab apple, and then a apple called Anna that sometimes produces two crops a year. It's a desert apple. It comes from Israel, and Dorset Golden comes from Bermuda, so they come from places you don't even think apples would grow. And then as you move along, you just keep hitting. Actually, if we go back in here, you can see an artichoke coming up, and a cardoon, which is a close relative of the artichoke that the Italians grow for the stalks. They use it a little like celery and put it in soups. And then there's flowers intermixed, and we just had a beautiful display of mint flowers on this mint that's growing here.
Definitely smell some wonderful fragrances here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, garden should be fragrant and beautiful, as well as feed us. And, you know, it just keeps, you know, just tree after tree. There's a hood pear next to the apples, and it's only about, 7 feet tall, because we're keeping it short to keep our view. It probably, most years, produces 30 to 60 pears on it, you know, in this relatively small tree. And right next to that is a plum called Burgundy that produces really tasty plums. Plums are probably the easiest fruit tree for beginners to grow. They're just so easy.
This goes against, because I know that a lot of people with a front yard this size would say, oh, I don't have room to grow fruit trees.
Yeah, if this was all the property you had, just a very modest, you know, area, you could have, there's probably 15 trees or so jammed into here along with other edible things. This is not the best time of year to see them, but there's a lot of blackberries around. And this is just an area we've cleared. We're probably going to put in a banana and some more roses. And
they'll get the heat from the wall.
Yeah. And so we go by more apricots. Another plum is our favorite plum. It's called Satsuma, and we have three of them, and they just produce endless fruit. Then we have, behind that, we have a lemon tree, and then way in the back corner is a lime and lots more berries.
Yeah, I can see the berries now as we're walking by.
So that's the front yard, and we can go to the backyard next.
Amazing.
We're in a shady area here on the side of the house where there's a hedge that doesn't produce anything edible, and we've been planting loquat seeds, and we're going to bring up a whole row of loquats, which are lovely fruit that come in early in the spring before anything else, and we'll use that as to replace the existing hedge over time as they grow up. We got the idea when a chance seedling took off, and now we have this huge loquat tree covered with fruit.
And those are so tasty and delicious.
Yeah, and they're flowery now, and they're really fragrant, too.
Now, is this your composter right here?
Yeah, we have three compost bins here. Two of them do worm composting, and this one was a gift. We got this free. Somebody was throwing it out.
Like a tumbler type.
Right, yeah, those are real handy. Yes. They make compost really fast. And then coming into the backyard, which is the biggest section of the yard, we definitely have a whole fruit forest going. And one of the things you'll notice, there's a lot of oak trees coming up. When we bought this place, there wasn't a single oak tree here, and probably from blue jays who spread the seed around. We've got a bunch of oaks coming up, and we'll harvest a little bit of firewood from them, but we're letting them grow, because in a food forest, eventually you want the top canopy, and they're the native here, and when they should be here, and they do provide an incredible amount of food. I went to a class taught by some Miwok Indian women from Yosemite, and they made acorn soup, and it was excellent. And it's certainly possible to prepare these acorns. People lived on them here. They were a big part of the diet. And they're a food source that we just throw away. I mean, thousands of pounds come from a single acorn. So we're letting most of these grow. And as I said, we'll get a bit of firewood from them, and we'll get lots and lots of other things. The first thing you see here are three terrace beds where we took most of the lawn out. And the remaining lawn, we just treat it as a path, is what it is. The lawn is just a path. And by terracing, you do a lot of water conservation, because we have a slope here, as you can see. And by making that flat, that water hits, and rather than roll down, it stays in the beds. At the end, you can see there's a berm or a small little hill we're building up with a crude rock wall, and that just helps the water stay here. So you're
capturing your rainwater, yeah. Basically.
Yeah, so we're capturing it with sort of micro-level earthworks, very small scale. They took no skill to build, didn't have to hire anybody. It was just digging. And then we use these for both a combination of perennial and annual vegetables and fruit. We use a lot of strawberries. And we're finding where the strawberries are doing best is near the rock walls, where they get a lot of extra heat. We have different herbs growing in it. We have fennel. We have very exotic crop here of edible cannas. People think of cannas as a flower. They're all over Santa Barbara, but the Incans ate them in a variety. Don't try and eat just any canna you have. It probably tastes pretty bad, but these have really tasty bulbs on them.
What does it taste like?
It tastes sort of like a crispy potato. We've tried sauteing them. You could probably roast them. Mm-hmm. They stay crisp, but it's sort of vaguely potato-like in flavor. I've got some turmeric that's just starting to come up. Not too many people grow turmeric here. And what we discovered, not only can you dry it as a powder, but the bulbs themselves, when they're fresh, as a relative of ginger, can be peeled and sort of julienne like little carrots. And it's an extremely healthy... It's a real cancer fighter, so it's a great thing to have. So I've been experimenting with it, and looks like it's really being quite successful.
I know. One thing I noticed about you and your wife, Linda, is that you both really utilize a lot of what you grow. You're constantly cooking and baking.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I just read an article called The Permaculture Kitchen, and it should really be very basic in permaculture, because if you grow this stuff, you have to know how to cook it. Mm-hmm. If you can't cook it, it doesn't do you much good.
That's why you always want to plant things you like to eat.
Right, yeah, yeah. We have some very exotic stuff, but we also have a lot of very mainstream stuff, and people should not feel like they have to plant just really exotic, strange things. We've experimented with those, and we're finding which ones taste good, and a lot of them do, but what we have that's kind of old-fashioned that we're standing right by now is a pair of quince trees, which are a distant relative of apples and pears, and used to be very popular. And right now inside, I'm cooking them with some apples to make an apple quince sauce. And then just to sort of make it a little richer, we threw some plums in. So we have an apple quince plum sauce. And there, again, there's another loquat growing maybe a foot from a quince tree, and nobody's hurting. They all produce fruit. They're all doing fine.
The loquats love you.
Yeah. And here's a nice little archway we have, and we've got we have roses growing up, and we have two grapes coming up either side. So it's some vertical space. Behind that's a peach and more loquats. When we first moved here, there was a big loquat tree, and it died. But while it was living, we were eating the loquats and throwing them around, and we discovered that if a loquat seed hits the ground, it grows. So we probably have 10 or 12 loquats now, and they're just coming back into heavy production. So
it loves to grow.
Yeah. And every loquat, you know, from seed tastes just slightly different, but mm-hmm. So far they've all been good.
Quince.
This is one of the two quinces.
Okay. It's really pretty.
Yeah.
Oh, there's the quince on there. I've seen those at the store, at Mesa Produce, actually.
Oh, yeah. Let's see if we can pick that one, because what's interesting about them is they're extremely fragrant. I don't know if I can get in there or not.
It's pretty far up, huh?
Yeah, you can probably smell it.
It smells like apple and pear mixed, kind of.
Yeah. And when they cook, the fragrance really comes out of them.
Wow.
They're a cooked fruit.
Very pretty.
Very good. Mm-hmm. They're sort of bland, raw. They're not very sweet. Mm-hmm. But when they cook, they're just wonderful. And over here is a bulb coming up, which I actually have to move to the shade. It doesn't like as much sun. Is a yacon, which has a bulb. But again, it's from the Incans. The Incans were great farmers, and they produced a lot of useful things. It's basically a bulb that's a fruit. It's sweet.
Heard about yacon that it's actually very, very good for people with diabetes.
Yeah, they used to take the leaves and make them into a tea that's supposed to help diabetes. Don't have diabetes, so I haven't tried, but I may just do it on general principles.
They're very sweet. I've tried,
right.
I've eaten them.
Right. And here's a couple of young macadamia nuts.
I thought it was macadamia.
Yeah, we want to get some protein going here, too.
I thought it was.
And we have spots here where two new low-chill cherries are going to go in that have just come on the market. So we can have cherries in Santa Barbara. We have another low-chill cherry just down the row.
I see your kale, too.
Yeah, we have been putting in more and more kale, really healthy green. I read this really funny story once where in the 17th century, a naturopathic physician was finishing his internship, and he was going to go out and find a town to set his practice up. And his instructor, the doctor he trained under, said, well, I have one last piece of advice to give you. Whatever town you go to, go around and look in the gardens. If they're growing kale, leave immediately. They don't need you.
They're already healthy. You won't make any money.
Yeah.
Oh, here's your oak trees. Are these volunteers?
Oak trees that are volunteering and coming up. And that's another thing in a permaculture garden is you don't fight what wants to grow here. And oaks want to grow here. So we're letting some of them come up instead of pulling them out. And they provide a great environment for a lot of native species. Here's a little nectarine. And behind that, hard to see because it's out, is a mulberry. It's a smaller mulberry. It'll be about a 10 or 12 foot bush. And right next to that is a California native elderberry. And we don't get too many of the fruit from that. The birds get it, but that's okay because they just love it. We get some fruit, but they get a lot of it. And we wanted to have some things that the birds would like. And it's another permaculture concept. They talk about sacrificial trees because while they're eating the elderberries, they're not bothering other fruit trees that we're using more.
Your plums and your nectarines.
And a lot of those same birds will be eating insects. And next to that, sort of our little native section, is a western redbud from the foothills of the Sierras. And it turns out that the native peoples in that area ate the flowers and the seed, which I didn't even know it was an edible when we put in. We probably know a small fraction of what's edible and native to this region, and we want to learn a lot more about the native edibles and put more of those in. And actually, right next to that is a plum that was a Luther Burbank plum. It's called Beauty, and it's a really luscious plum.
Well, it's living up to its name.
Yeah.
It's gorgeous.
Yeah,
is this the mother loquat tree?
It's another loquat tree. They're everywhere on this property. I think if people disappeared, there'd be oaks and loquats because they're so drought tolerant. They're so easy to grow. They're a great windshade tree, and they just produce. And on either side of it are a pair of Chinese pears, which are beautiful trees. growing up the tree, and we're going to be putting more in, are chayotes, the Mexican squash, which has edible leaves, it has the fruit that's edible, and in Mexico they even eat the roots. Every part of it is useful.
We had those in Hawaii. Yeah. I remember they were giant.
And behind that is one of my favorite apple trees. It's called White Winter Pear Mane. There's some debate about it, but a lot of people think it dates from about 1250 AD in England. It's an old English apple, and it's the miracle is that it grows here in Southern California. You think it would need a lot more chill.
Which of these plants were originally here when you got here, Larry?
There was one guava and an orange tree, and there wasn't many other fruit trees. So basically, over 14 years, we've been putting them all in. And actually, back in there is our Lucania tree, which I need to harvest now, full of edible seed pods. Yeah, it's a nitrogen-fixing tree.
Now, what do you do with the seed pods?
Well, if they're green, you can actually steam them and eat them like string beans. When they get hard, I grind them and mix them in with flour and bread to make a little extra protein.
For your famous bread?
Yeah. About the last thing to see here is some of the herbs we have, and we want to really expand those. Yeah. But we're putting in a lot of heritage roses now. My wife really got interested in this, and they're really fun. They smell better. They're quite exquisite. These are the older roses, and what happened starting maybe in the 30s or 40s as pesticides came in is rose breeders started breeding all the modern hybrid teas that we see everywhere on the assumption that people would be using poison. So a lot of them, when you take the poison away, you can make some of them do well in an organic garden, but some of them are just difficult roses. And these older roses have survived from an era when people didn't have pesticides, so they're tougher roses, and they're quite beautiful.
Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And that was a backyard tour of Linda and Larry Saltzman's permaculture food forest. And you are tuned in to Sustainable World on KCSB 91.9 FM in Santa Barbara. And I'm Jill Cloutier. And my guest today is Larry Saltzman, the person who planted that amazing permaculture food forest. So, Larry, I would love to find out, and we did have a caller, and we will get to your question in a moment. But I would love to find out, Larry, how did you and Linda make this transformation? How did this start from a suburban lawn to an edible oasis that occurred on your property? What inspired you to do this? Do you have a background in horticulture?
No, I don't have a background in horticulture. Both of us were interested in gardening, and we tried to do some in Venice where we lived before we moved up from LA to Santa Barbara. But we were determined when we come here we were going to have the best sized property we could afford and get into gardening. And I think the threads that we brought to it is Linda, coming from Eastern Canada, had a love for English country gardening, and traditional English country gardening was very sustainable. And I was interested in the work of a Japanese farmer named Fukuoka, who wrote a book called The One Straw Revolution, and it was one of the important precursors of permaculture. And so we started putting all that together, and I had this crazy idea we could maybe grow a lot of the food we ate, and it slowly came together. And then we discovered permaculture and discovered we were sort of doing some of it and started learning more.
Wow. So you were doing it innately. It just came out of you. You were a natural permaculturist.
I guess so.
Well, Larry, and so basically instead of your background being in horticulture, it was in Hollywood.
Yeah, I worked as a film editor on documentary films in Hollywood. Linda and I worked for Jacques Cousteau, and I worked on a lot of the early National Geographic documentaries.
And what a transformation from that to having a backyard food forest. Amazing.
Yeah, although the kind of documentaries I worked on, there was a lot of nature involved, so maybe that helped.
Well, let's start. We've had a couple callers already this morning, which is great, and let's start first. What was the property like? I think you were just alluding to this when you, and I might have missed something because I was on the phone with a caller. What was the property like when you first moved in? And I hope that listeners got an idea of what it's like now. It's just like brimming with life. It's amazing. Was there just grass there or what?
No, there wasn't just grass there, although there was a lot more grass. And it was actually very well laid out. The aesthetically, the shape of it was very nice in the way the beds were laid out. And we've never actually touched it. Happens it was owned by an old English gentleman, so it was sort of the style of what we wanted anyway. But it was being terribly maintained. People were coming in with blowers every week, blowing leaves off and blowing topsoil away. And every hedge was just pruned within an inch of its life very formally. So we began to let things go looser and, you know, just more natural. Mm-hmm. And then just started slowly replacing certain plants with others that were more desirable.
Mm-hmm. And what is pretty much everything that you've planted edible, or do you also have some ornament? It's not, you do have some ornamentals, it sounds like.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, some of them could be edible, and some of them could have been used medicinally or could have been used for fiber. But they're important part of guilds, too, that we alluded to, were companion plants, where some of them provide homes for beneficial insects, others provide, you know, places for pollinators to get nectar all through the year, and they also provide beauty in the garden.
And it sounds like what your food forest is, and maybe permaculture as well, is like a whole systems approach.
That's
and
right.
Instead of isolating like mm-hmm. one fruit tree and kind of, because I noticed none of your trees were alone.
Right.
Yeah. They were all surrounded. And is our guilds, could you talk a little bit about guilds?
Yeah. So people, organic garden, call it companion planting, but it gets into a part of Darwin that everybody forgets about, which is part of evolution was cooperation. It wasn't just competition. So certain plants cooperate and work together. One plant might provide windbreak or shade for another plant. There's even evidence of certain plants exchanging beneficial bacteria between their root systems. Certain plants will keep bad insects away. Others will provide homes for beneficial insects. So there's just all kinds of way that plants help and benefit each other. Mm-hmm. I mean, a tree provides structure for a vine to grow on it.
Interesting. So it's almost like they benefit each other so much, they help each other grow.
Mm-hmm.
And so, oh, interesting. It's kind of like people, too.
Right.
Yeah, interesting. So in the past, did you have lawns in the past? Where you lived in Venice? Or were you that aware of your yard or...
Well, we had a teeny bit of lawn because mm-hmm. we had a postage stamp size yard in Venice. It was mm-hmm. one of the frustrating things about living there. We tried to landscape it, but it was just very, very teeny, so we couldn't really do too much.
Because mm-hmm. what I'm wondering is, how much time and effort do you put into your food forest as opposed to someone that has like a typical suburban lawn?
Well, I don't know if I could quantify it. It doesn't take that many hours to maintain a maturing food forest, a bit of pruning and stuff, but because we let leaves fall into all the beds and don't, you know, pick them up, you know, we just let them compost in place. There's a lot of things that we just don't do. I mean, one of the big tasks is harvesting the fruit. And what my wife likes to say is the exercise we do get, we're not paying somebody to do. We're not paying to go to a gym while we pay somebody else to do our yard work.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all very pleasurable and hardly matters.
And would you say that a lot of the food that you eat comes from your yard? How much would you guess?
I'm not certain right uh-huh. now. We still take get a lot of our vegetables, leafy green vegetables from local organic farmers, and that's fine because they really have the land to grow those in greater quantity than we can. But there's times during the summer where for many, many weeks we don't have to go out and buy fruit. Maybe we'll choose to buy something that we're not growing because we want it. But, you know, I'm imagining within 5 years we can maybe get 30%, 40%.
Wow. That's
There's
amazing.
People who've done better, you know, who've done this full time, who've really become almost self-sustaining on under an acre.
But when I look at where you're living, it's in a suburban area in Santa Barbara. It's pretty amazing to be able to get 30% of your fruit from, because it's expensive.
Right.
You have to buy that in the store, especially organic food is quite expensive.
Mm-hmm.
So you're probably saving a lot of money. Now, when you moved to this land, it probably hadn't been gardened organically. Did you start out or using organic methods, or is that something you learned along the way?
No, we definitely wanted to do organic, and we definitely started out organic. We immediately stopped all the spraying. You know, there was a Eugenia hedge,
mm-hmm.
and Eugenias were getting terribly attacked in Santa Barbara at the time by a pest.
What are Eugenias? Are they?
Well, they're used as hedges, and they have dark purple berries, which actually are also edible.
Mm-hmm.
They come from Australia, New Guinea, and they want to be a 65-foot tree, but people use them here as a hedge.
Uh-huh.
And when we stopped the spraying on those hedges, which the previous owner thought was necessary, the thing got healthier because there was a chance for predatory insects to move in that were eating the pest that was ruining the plant.
Wow. And that was, so that's how you first noticed, that was one of the first times you could really, or instances where you could see that it was working mm-hmm. to use organics. Now, did you, how do you maintain, like, how do you do pest control? I know you're a co-founder of the Organic Garden Club, and maybe you could speak about that too. How do you maintain health in your garden without the use of pesticides or herbicides?
The stage the garden's at now, mm-hmm. we do nothing. I'm probably one of the worst people to talk to about, well, what do you do if you get this pest, or what do you do if you get that pest? We do nothing. I mean, there's so much biodiversity. Birds have been invited in. There's lots of beneficial insects. And so we basically do nothing. If occasional plant with that much diversity cannot survive, we let it go. It's just not meant to be in that garden. Now, when you're first starting out and you're converting a garden, you know, a lot of people need to go through a transition stage where they replace the nasty chemicals with more benign chemicals, things like safer soap and different things that aren't so toxic and persistent and will help them make the transition to organic. But the more biodiversity you bring in and the more you healthier soil you develop, pretty soon you're going to need to do less and less.
Interesting. How much time would you say that you and Linda put into harvesting and maintaining your food forest?
I imagine in an average week we could be, certain times, you know, it varies by time of the year, but we could be out there 4 hours a week, and maybe at some times of the year, 6 or 8. It doesn't take long, you know, when fruit trees are in, mm-hmm. to harvest enough fruit to pick for breakfast or lunch or something, and it's just not that bad.
Mm-hmm. And I know you both work, too, so this isn't something that you have to, you know, have a trust fund and not work to do. There's people that are working that actually do harvest their food from their backyard food forests.
Right.
Yeah, because you're working a lot, Larry, I know.
Mm-hmm.
Now, do you, I noticed when we went on the tour, and I didn't bring this up in the audio tour, but I noticed that a lot of your land was mulched. And why, could you explain to our listeners what mulch is and why it's so important?
Well, it's extremely important for a lot of reasons. Soil needs a lot of organic matter to be healthy. The level of bacteria and mycorrhizal or fungus that's in the soil directly speaks to the health of the soil. And the healthier the soil, the more nutrient uptake there is. And also it also brings the more organic matter in the soil, the more worms come and convert that material into nutrients that the plants can use much better. So, and then also mulch and compost form a layer on the top of the soil that holds water in, and especially in our dry summer climate, you want to hold as much of the moisture that you've captured in the winter in the soil. So there's two kinds of mulching we do. We do mulching with all the dead plant debris, a lot of which we just leave in place. We don't even take it to the compost bins and compost it, which means speed up that breakdown to release the nutrients. And then there's also a lot of living mulch where we do plantings of very low-level plants that are close to the ground that do a lot of the same stuff that the plant debris does.
And I noticed, too, on the tour that there were no PVC pipes, like, coiled about on your property. So does the mulch help with not having to use that irrigation? And how do you water all of those plants?
Well, we don't water a lot of them, and that's the goal. And you don't just have to buy, you know, the sort of well-known drought-tolerant plants to have a low-water garden. The first step is you want to capture as much winter water as you can in the ground, and we try and do that through various techniques of berms or little hills and swales. But once it's in the ground, we want to hold it in the ground, and the best way to hold it is to have lots of plants that take it up, a lot of mulch to keep it from evaporating. And we're finding now that, except in an extremely drought year, a lot of the mature fruit trees have put down deep enough roots because they haven't been so surface watered that they're making it through a summer and producing a crop without any extra water.
Wow. And I know there's a big, huge yard and kind of garden behind our house, and they water that garden and yard probably 3 times a week for an hour at about 4 in the morning because mm-hmm. it wakes us up. But that just seems like overwatering to me. And all your trees are so healthy, so it's an interesting contrast.
Right, yeah. You don't have to, if you plant it and build this upright, you don't have to do that much watering. I think there's a certain discipline in only having a hose. It's more work to water, and it makes you think about watering. It makes you plan strategies where you don't. It's almost, I mean, you can do good things with drip irrigation, but in some ways, it's almost too easy.
Mm-hmm. And plus, the PVC now they're finding out is not the best thing for the soil.
Never had a doubt that it would turn out to be bad.
Yes. Well, what we'll do is we'll take a short music break, and we did have a couple callers, and we'll get to your questions after the break. If you do have a question for Larry Saltzman, you can call the station at 805-893-2424, and we will pick up your call. And I'm going to play a song by Jack Johnson, and this is Sustainable World on KCSB 91.9 FM. We'll be right back after this song.
Do you remember when we first met? I sure do. It was sometime in early September. Though you were lazy about it, you made me wait around. I was so crazy about you, I didn't mind. So I was late for class, I locked my back to yours. It wasn't hard to find your painted flowers on. Guess that I was afraid that if you rolled away, you might not roll back my direction real soon. Well, I was crazy about you then and now, but the craziest thing of all, over 10 years have gone. You're still mine, locked in time. Let's rewind. Do you remember when we first moved in together? The piano took up the living room. You'd play me boogie woogie, I'd play you love songs. Say we're playing house. Now you still say we are. We built our getaway up in a tree we found. We felt so far away, but we were still in town. Now I remember watching that old tree burn down. I took a picture that I don't like to look at. Well, all these times they come and go, and alone don't seem so long. Over 10 years have gone by. We can't rewind, we're locked in time, but you're still mine. Do you remember?
And you're listening to KCSB 91.9 FM in Santa Barbara, and I'm Jill Cloutier for Sustainable World, and my guest today is Larry Saltzman, a backyard food forester, co-founder of the Santa Barbara Organic Garden Club, and many other things. And we've been talking about Larry and Linda's Linda Bazell's backyard food forest. We did have some callers, and we'll get to your questions right now, callers. The first caller wanted to know, what fruit trees will grow in Santa Barbara, Larry, that aren't too big, that won't get too big if she has a small space?
Okay, well, actually, almost any fruit tree, because particularly with all the apples, citruses, pears, stone fruit, most of those trees are grafted trees, where they take a piece of wood from a desirable type tree and they graft it onto what's called a rootstock. And those rootstocks have been developed to be disease-resistant, but also for size. So you can get a dwarf, semi-dwarf, or full-size tree in almost any fruit tree you want. And then there's a few, true dwarfs. There's actually a dwarf avocado. There's dwarf lemons. There's a couple of dwarf peaches and almonds. So it's pretty easy to get fruit trees. And you can prune them for size. It's not very hard to summer prune trees and keep them contained.
Okay, so pretty much anything in Santa Barbara, and it sounded like plums were pretty easy for beginners. Mm-hmm. Do you think a plum would be able to stay pretty small? You could prune it and...
Oh, yeah, you can get plums that just go to about 6-8 feet.
Mm-hmm. Cool. And if you have any more questions, give us a call back about the fruit trees, caller at 893-2424. And also, Larry, we had another person that called, and they wanted to know if you give guided tours of your property.
Yeah, through the Organic Garden Club and Santa Barbara Permaculture, we do maybe about 4 of those a year. It's a little introductory class to applying permaculture design principles to home gardening. So we cover the food forest and some of the basic principles of permaculture and tour the garden. And if anybody wants to do that, the best thing to do is email me at L, B as in boy, Saltzman, S-A-L-T, as in Tom, Z-M-A-N, at AOL.com, and we'll put you on the email list to get notices.
Perfect. And then our other caller wanted to know if you have a website.
And the answer is not really. We handle it all with a listserv. Maybe one of these days we will, but we just haven't gotten to that.
What if someone wanted to join the Santa Barbara Organic Garden Club? What do you have to do?
Well, just email at that address, and the club membership is free, and our events are free, so it's just a question of getting notices of the events and coming.
Okay, great. And I actually went to an event that you put on last Saturday, which was really great, on how to start seeds, and that was great. Are you going to have more events like that coming up in the future?
Yeah, we're pretty done for this year, but next year we'll do our fruit forest tours. The person who did that event, Oscar Kimona, wants to do one on seed saving, and we like to just keep covering varieties of basic organic gardening techniques to help beginners and intermediate and even advanced gardeners improve their skills.
That's great. I've been to a few of your events. They're always really, really fun. So, Larry, what would you like to talk about next, as far as we have so many topics we could cover today?
Well, we were talking before the show started about what we're doing with relocalizing food, and that gets into some bigger issues. Mm-hmm. You know, aside from how much money we save individually, it's one of the best ways anybody can contribute to cutting down dependence on oil. The amount of energy that's pumped into our food production and maintenance system is huge, so that people have estimated for every calorie of food we consume, it took anywhere from 8 to 15 calories of hydrocarbons or fossil fuels to produce that food.
Wow, that's
so
amazing.
So anything that people can do to grow whatever portion of the food they eat themselves, or to buy it from local organic sources within 100 miles of where we live, you're making a tremendous contribution to national security, cutting down our dependence on oil, fighting global warming, and all that, and the fact that the world is beginning to run out of cheap oil, you know. So this is one of the most productive things you can do. If you're able to eat all your food from within 100 miles from home, then you would probably save as much gasoline, as much oil a year as you consume in driving your car.
Wow. That's amazing. Now, do you think it's possible to do that, to eat within 100 miles of where you live?
Absolutely. It's starting to happen more and more. We were just in Northern California, and more restaurants and markets are advertising that they buy local organic wherever possible. And communities all over the country are beginning to wake up to this and take action. It doesn't even take the government getting involved. Mm-hmm. We can just do it.
Now, what about things like rice and grains? Would that be hard for us here in Santa Barbara to, you know, get that if peak oil does occur? Well, I know peak oil has occurred, but if we do get impacted by this, are we going to have to give up things like that?
Well, I mean, the day will come when I think those things are going to get much more expensive unless they're grown closer to home. I mean, we're not, some of the grains we could grow very well here and others not, but we could certainly grow grain here. And I went to a seminar taught by a man from Ojai who is saving all the ancient grains and saving their seeds and growing crops of those. And he estimated it took a 20 by 20 square of land, 20 feet by 20 feet, to grow enough grain to produce a crop that would provide a loaf of bread a week for 52 weeks of the year.
Wow. So 20 by 20. Wow.
So we could be growing grain here, and we could be getting more independent on that, too.
So the ideal thing would be to have just one farmer that's growing a certain type of grain, and then you can grow your own vegetables at your house, because it's probably not practical for a...
Yeah, I mean, yeah. There's going to be certain things we need from farmers. We don't want to get rid of... We want to support our local farmers. We don't want to do this to drive them out of business. We want to support them because they're going to be able to grow certain things in quantity that we might not be able to.
And we've been talking a lot on this show lately about how local farmers, it's getting harder and harder to farm in Santa Barbara. So do you see that as a matter of utmost importance, especially with peak oil occurring?
Yeah, absolutely. We've got to save every square inch of farmland that's left, and we have to start supporting local farmers, even the non-organic ones, because they can be in time they're going to convert to organic. I have no doubt about it, as fossil fuel-based pesticides and fertilizers get too expensive. And there's been even talk about the fact that, you know, we need low-cost housing and let's use the farmland. But to me, that's saying we're going to build housing for people and they're not going to be able to eat, you know, because there's going to be no land left to grow food. We don't have that much land left on the South Coast. Mm-hmm. We should be protecting every square inch of farmland that's left.
Mm-hmm. Instead, and maybe making use of what buildings we have already.
Right. You know, where we need to do low-cost housing and things, we need to do, we need to infill, you know, more in the more already developed urban areas. And it, somehow it always seems that whenever there's talk about covering up farmland, it's always going to be with giant McMansions. It's never going to be with low-cost housing anyway. Somehow that never gets built.
Yeah, it's true. And I just heard something about how in China, the government is buying up acres and acres and acres of farmland and paying the farmers very well for it. So this is kind of a worldwide phenomena.
Yeah, I mean, food worldwide is in great jeopardy. Global warming is going to really affect food production. Aquifers are being depleted. Our home method of how we produce food and ship it around the world is a catastrophically stupid idea, and we're going to be forced to change. So people who are smart enough to start changing now before it gets to be a catastrophe are doing themselves and the planet a lot of good.
Now, Larry, what would you say would be some of the most useful things that someone could do to help protect their own food supply and to ensure their food security in the future?
Encourage any restaurant you go to and any market you shop at to carry and advertise the fact that they carry as much local food as possible. If you can, grow what you can grow. There's going to be a meeting next week of people in the Mesa that want to start a pilot project that I hope spreads to the whole city to have whole community up in the Mesa get as many people as possible growing food and sharing the food with each other, trading. So one person grows plums and another grows almonds and another grows avocados. You know, not everybody's going to do what we've done with close to 70 food-bearing trees in a property, but if a whole neighborhood gets together and everybody grows something and shares the surpluses, we're all going to be better off. And there's a lot of land in Santa Barbara now on everybody's home.
Do you think, so getting together with your neighbors is a great idea. What else could someone do? Say that you have a modest suburban lawn in your front yard. What would you suggest to people to do with that space?
If you're not willing to rip it all out, one of the things we did to build our courage up is just go around the perimeter and cut out the beds another foot a year. Just cut them down a foot a year, less work, and grow something there. And you can, you know, you don't have to have your vegetables in formal beds. You can take something like a purple kale that's a beautiful plant and mix it next to flowers. You can put colored chard next to flowers and other plants that are just ornamental. So you can intermix them all around, and just every square foot of new space you create, if you dedicated some of it to food, you'll be amazed how much you start producing.
And would you say that there's strong interest in this in Santa Barbara?
I think the interest is growing. I remember when we first went to permaculture meetings where my wife and I would be the only two people there. I remember when we had garden club meetings where four or five people would show up. And now I'm shocked if we have less than 30 people, and more calls come in all the time, and more people want to do things. I just had a call yesterday from a nutritionist in town here named Jerry French, who wants to start a whole sustainability program and on growing your own food and integrate that in with good nutrition and it's a great and good cooking, you know.
Well, that's one thing too, Lauren. We only have probably 5 minutes left, but I wanted to talk to you. Number one is, I know you make this amazing bread that you, don't you grind your own grain or something? What do you do?
Yeah, I grind my own grain for bread. It tastes much better.
And you and Linda, when I went over there, I'm sure the listeners heard you were making the plum quince sauce. And it seems like you really know a lot about the old ways of preparing food. And how do you learn about this? And how would someone find out how to utilize all of this food that they're going to be getting?
Well, good. I think we know a little about the old ways of preparing food. I think all of us know a little about this. I think a lot of the skills have been lost. But I'm very interested in seeing that we regain those. I mean, you start reading, you start finding people who know how to cook, you start learning how to cook with local available ingredients. They used to do a lot more of that, the farmer's market, and I'm very disappointed they stopped doing that. But people need help from chefs, and there's chefs that are getting interested in local regional preparation. You need to find old books and learn old recipes. And I'd say for this climate, Mediterranean climate, read what they're doing in every other Mediterranean climate in the world, mm-hmm. because we can do it here. You know, we have the same, we can grow the same range of things. I'm reading a wonderful book now called Tending the Wild by a woman named M. Cat Anderson, who's an ethnoecologist, and she's compiled the most comprehensive book of how Native Americans in California lived, how they managed the landscape extensively. They were master horticulturists. They were not simple hunter-gatherers. They had a very rich, sophisticated culture, and they were producing huge surpluses of food out of this landscape, most of which we've destroyed through bad management techniques and forcing them into our way of life rather than the other way. But a lot of that knowledge survived, and there's a lot we can learn from the people who lived in this region and from the native plants that they used.
What, I know you were mentioning something before we came on the air about the, was it sugar pine forests?
Yeah, well, that's more up towards mm-hmm. the Sierras, but mm-hmm. a lot of the tribes, you know, they definitely encouraged which trees grew in different areas, and they grew different trees, and the sugar pine, which I think is the, also what they call the ponderosa, mm-hmm. was greatly encouraged, and they actually did get sugar from it. It was like the maples back east, and it was greatly desired. So, you know, and they also encouraged oak forests for the acorns. They had other pines that they got seed from and bark that they could use medicinally. And, you know, it goes on and on and on.
So it's really, they were managing their forests. It wasn't just,
And they were managing their prairie land, too. They, a lot of the wildflower displays that people like John Muir saw, who they thought were wild nature, were these giant tracts of hundreds of acres of spring greens that people ate.
Amazing. Wow. And Larry, you know, I would love to hear too, since we're talking a bit about nutrition and food, I noticed online, and I actually, you gave me a handout on it once too, you had redesigned the food pyramid. And I'm wondering if you could give us a really brief introduction to that. That was very interesting.
Yeah, and actually, there's a website you can go to see it, forthefuture.org. So I sort of misspoke when I said we don't have a website. That's this group I'm involved in. We don't have one for the Santa Barbara Organic Garden Club. But we do, For the Future does have a website, and you'll see it there. My idea for the food pyramid, which is very political and corrupt, the one that you see that comes out of the government.
The Dairy Council.
The big mainstream food industry has too much control of it. The base of it, the largest portion of what we eat, should be homegrown or local organic food from within the 100 miles. The next smallest one should be organic foods from farther away that we can't grow locally. You know, although there's very little, amazing how little we can't grow mm-hmm. in Santa Barbara. But, and then the top of it should be things that are shipped from halfway around the world that are sort of very expensive, maybe gourmet items. It's the smallest part of our diet. So that, and I was arguing that if you're eating local grown food, organically raised, you know, you might want to talk to a nutritionist about the balance of things. You're going to be eating a pretty healthy diet. You don't have to worry about all the stuff that they're pushing down our throats from the food industry. And the other thing that it's not actually in the food pyramid to think about is the food we get from afar should be sustainably grown and true surpluses of a local economy, not commodity growing that was forced on a peasant population that's keeping them semi-starved and growing. But if they're in the tropics and they're growing their own food and they have too many papayas or bananas and they want to share the surplus with us, that's more acceptable than the factory farming that's imposed on rainforests, things like that. And I think eventually we're going to have to demand that things that do come from afar are sustainably shipped. There are plans for building sail ships that will compete with diesel engines that will travel quite quickly mm-hmm. to move things, you know. So all that has to come together.
And that opens up a whole new realm of sustainable transport.
That's right.
Yes. And I could see, too, there's a vast difference between we're going in and using up this land to grow food for us and sharing the surplus. Instead of depletion, it's surplus.
That's right.
Yeah. And is that, do you know if that's happening? Like, is a lot of the things that we get in our, like, gourmet health food stores, do you think any of that is surplus?
Well, it's beginning to happen. It's beginning to happen with coffee. You should certainly look for things that are fair traded. And where they're making a point of the fact that the local growers are sharing in the profits and receiving a fair price and aren't just essentially slave labor.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So Larry, we are just about at the end, to the end, and I am wondering if you could once again give your contact information for our listeners.
Well, you can go to forthefuture.org, or you can also email me at lbsaltzman@aol.com.
And that's Saltzman with a Z.
Yeah, T-Z-M-A-N.
Okay, great. And thank you so much for joining us. And do you have anything else you would like to share with our listeners?
No, today? I think we've covered a lot.
Okay. Great. We'll have to do another food tour in the spring, and or in the, I guess in the spring or summer is when things would
be. Spring's when things are the prettiest.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was so gorgeous the other day, so that will be great. And you've been listening to Sustainable World on KCSB 91.9 FM in Santa Barbara. I'm Jill Cloutier. My guest today was Larry Saltzman of the Santa Barbara Organic Garden Club. And next week is our fun drive here at KCSB, so I hope you'll tune in. And if you like shows like this, next week will be the time to show your support for all the great shows at KCSB. So we'll be back next week, and thanks for tuning in. Bye-bye.